Come on, let's have a look at those ghosts.
Catapults of propaganda. The truth out there.
Some alien race to come down and threaten us.
The military industrial complex.
Highly funded yet unofficial government agency. Take the red pill.
If this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier.
Welcome to PID Radio. I'm Derek Gilbert.
And I'm Sharon Gilbert, everybody. And we have such an exciting show for you tonight. We're recording this on, let's see, is it going to go up tonight?
It is going to go up tonight.
I'm a little confused because we're doing some shows in advance. This is March the 2nd.
Yes.
Of course, there's a big election going on in Russia. But believe it or not, we don't have Putin on the phone.
No.
We have a better show.
Medvedev.
Medvedev.
Yeah.
Very good.
In fact, we've done several political shows in a row, so we wanted to turn our attention back to the real focus of peering into darkness, which is the existence of a world that's just beyond the range of human senses most of the time.
Exactly. If you've listened to Peering into Darkness, PID Radio, for very long, then you know that both Derek and I are Christians, and we come at the world, the spiritual world, with really open eyes. Mm-hmm. We're really trying to see what's out there and find ways in Scripture that we can, you know, reconcile this. We're not afraid to look into places that many Christians are just kind of ignoring these days. So we often have guests on that really take off in directions that we think are very interesting, especially mm-hmm. because of the supernatural battle.
Exactly right. And our guest tonight is a gentleman who's been interested in the supernatural for a long, long time. And he approaches it with a journalistic with the experience and the eye of a journalist. He's the he's a newspaper columnist. He's in fact a journalism professor at Northwest Missouri State University, home of the Fighting Bearcats, and the author.
Go Bearcats.
Yes, the author of Haunted Missouri: A Ghostly Guide to the Show Me State's Most Spirited Spots. And we welcome to PID Radio Jason Offutt. Jason, welcome.
Hey, thank you very much for having me on the show.
No, we're happy to do it. And we had the opportunity to talk a couple of times back in Missouri at the Eagle 93.9, but we're happy to have you on PID Radio.
You know, we probably got some listeners from back in Missouri who now listen to PID Radio because of your show then. And so they're going, yay, Jason's back.
That's right.
Hopefully it's not that guy again.
Yeah. Well, we did some very interesting Off-Road Friday shows, and so we wanted to get a chance to talk to you about your work and your interest in the paranormal, especially with your new book coming up that you're working on. We'll get into that in just a little bit, too. But in addition to writing a regular column about life in general, which he posts at the blog called Poop's Funny, he does a weekly column which he posts on the paranormal, which he posts to a blog called From the Shadows. And we'll put links to all of these sites that we'll mention tonight, and of course a link to Jason's book, Haunted Missouri, in the show notes at PIDradio.com. But Jason, why the paranormal? Why did you get interested in it in the first place?
Well, there were a couple of reasons, and the reasons being experiences that I had when I was a kid. One of the ones that really stuck with me, I was maybe about 8, 9, 10 years old, and was walking into a hallway one Saturday afternoon to get a book. It's where we kept our encyclopedias, and when I walked into the hallway, it was well lit. I saw a boy who looked to be about 6 or 7 years old. I could tell he had brown hair. He was wearing a flannel shirt and blue jeans, and I could see the bookshelf through him. I didn't get scared. To this day, I don't understand why I wasn't scared, but I just turned around and walked into my room and shut my door and didn't come out for a few hours. Never saw this little boy again, nobody in my family. After I talked to them 30 years after the experience, they'd never experienced anything. So, I mean, I don't know if it was an overactive imagination of a child or if I really did see something, but that made a really distinct impression on me.
Now, how did that experience and your interest in the paranormal then affect your decision to become a journalist?
Well, you know, actually that had absolutely nothing to do with me deciding to become a journalist. I had wanted to be a writer ever since I was about 10 years old. I told people one day that I wanted to write books when I grew up, and everybody, of course, laughed, patted me on the head, and said, oh, that's cute. So I always had that in mind. I was always working on writing, and I never wanted to be a journalist. So when I graduated from college with a broadcasting degree, the first first job I found in the media was a reporting job, and I took it and spent 18 years as a newspaper reporter and editor. I just fell in love with it. And it was through that I kind of honed, you know, my investigative skills that have really helped me with tracking down paranormal activity.
Well, you know, the thing, because of the way you approach it as a journalist, I mean, you are trained to take an objective look, try to find ways to explain every side of the issue. You're really taking a hard, you know, cold look at the facts of something that traditionally is very subjective.
Yes, I'm glad people do realize that and think of it that way. I was just given a compliment just like that recently. I was interviewing a physics professor. One of the next, I've got two book projects I'm working on right now. One is about the shadow people. And this physics professor said he's really interested in the paranormal also, but since he's a scientist, he views it, you know, as a scientist. And I want to present to my reading audience all of the possible aspects of what these phenomena could be. I'm going to have the physics of shadow people in my next book, along with the psychological and biochemical reasons as to what these creatures might be.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about Haunted Missouri, your book that, as I understand, has become the best-selling book in the history of Truman University Press. Do I remember that correctly?
Yes.
Yeah, congratulations on that, by the way.
Say, yes, thank you.
So what led to that book project?
I pitched an idea to Missouri Life magazine about ghost stories, and this was in 2004. I just wanted to finally start writing some ghost stories, and they liked the idea. So they commissioned me to write this story, and it was through that I was contacted by a publishing company to write a book. And when they contacted me, I was elated. This article that I was just happy enough to get has led to a book. I got a contract, a nice advance from this company, and then they closed their book publishing division, and I was sort of out in the cold. But Truman State University picked it up fairly quickly after that. But it was kind of lucky to fall into it.
How did you gather the stories?
Well, I did a lot of research beforehand. Being from Missouri, I knew a lot of these places. The Wilson's Creek Battlefield down in Springfield, Missouri, is a famous, at least in the state, Civil War spot. There were a couple other Civil War spots in the state. There was a fort that was founded by Meriwether Lewis that is very close to Kansas City. It's in one of the suburbs. So I knew about a lot of these. Other ones I found doing some research on the internet. I also knew I wanted to cover some of the larger cities, so I went there and looked in libraries to try and find some old stories, and contacted people from historical societies and did things that way. A lot of groundwork.
I wondered if you did it that way. That's a great idea. Did you find that the ghost stories tended to be regional in flavor?
Make that a little bit more specific. What do you mean by regional in flavor?
Well, I know that there are certain areas in Missouri that they would have stories that maybe are more hauntings, and then other stories that are more poltergeists, and some stories where they actually get into the supernatural creature aspect, which I know isn't technically haunted, but I just wondered if there are some areas that are hot spots or...
Well, I found there are a number around the Kansas City area. There are a number of good ones around the St. Louis area. I'm guessing just because of the size of the cities, you know, there are more deaths than other places. I didn't really get into a lot of poltergeist activity. The creatures, I did find a few, but didn't touch them for this book just because they weren't hauntings.
Sure.
Although there was a great one from Rolla, Missouri, which is in southeastern Missouri, some creature called the Goat Man.
The Goat Man?
Yeah, it's kind of, the description sounds kind of like Pan, uh-huh. You know, I've talked to people who've actually claimed that a relative has seen this thing back in the day, but I couldn't ever really get anybody to talk to me about it. But again, that wasn't wasn't really something haunted. It was just something creepy.
Well, as far as the hauntings go, what are the most, say, well-attested hauntings that you found in the research for Haunted Missouri?
One of the best ones was the Limp Mansion in St. Louis.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, which was, I don't remember, USA Today, 10, 15 years ago maybe, put it at one of the top 10 haunted spots in the country. And there were, which is, it's interesting because this very wealthy family that even stayed kind of wealthy, they were beer barons, they stayed kind of wealthy after Prohibition, but they committed suicide one after another after another. So with that kind of a history in the house, I'm not really surprised there are a lot of hauntings there.
What are some of the stories that come out about the Limp Mansion?
Well, the like I said, a number of people have committed suicide. The father, and then William Limp Jr. and a couple of his brothers. One died in the house. The other committed suicide in the house. There have been people throughout the years who have reported seeing and hearing spirits in the house. One of the more interesting ones was a dog. One of the Limp sons had a Doberman Pinscher that it was just, he loved the dog, and he was going to kill himself. And he said, you know what, nobody likes my dog. Nobody's going to take care of my dog, so I'm going to take care of my dog right now. So he killed the dog before he killed himself. And it's a bed and breakfast now, and people have reported hearing, you know, the fingernails or the toenails of a dog clip, you know, when they're walking across the hardwood floor,
yeah,
clicking,
yeah,
in rooms that are now carpeted.
Hmm.
Oh, that's really creepy.
Yeah, people have reported to the manager of the bed and breakfast that, you know, there's a dog barking in the middle of the night inside the house, and of course there wasn't because there's no dogs there. But one of the neatest things, a friend of mine from high school lives in St. Louis, and he and his wife went with me when I took my tour and investigation of the Limp Mansion. And it was summer, and they were both wearing shorts, and they were sitting downstairs waiting for me to finish my tour of the building. And my friend's wife felt a dog brush up against her leg, and she had not heard the story of the dog on the building.
Hmm.
So I thought that was pretty interesting.
How did she react when she heard the story?
Oh, her eyes got pretty big.
Well, along that line, do you find that most of the people who are telling you the stories about hauntings, do you think that they're comfortable with them or uncomfortable with them, terrified?
It's a little bit of both. Most of the people I've talked to are fairly comfortable with it because there have been most of the hauntings that I covered were not really very threatening. Some, of course, were accepting of it. You know, hey, this is my house. I live here, but I know you're not going to leave, ghosts, so I'll just put up with you. That sort of relationship. A few have been scared. Most of the people who have been scared have set up at 3 o'clock in the morning and saw a man standing at the end of their bed.
It's funny you should say 3 a.m. because we have heard from a lot of people who specialize in the supernatural and in hauntings, and a couple of people who actually are exorcists, mm-hmm, believe it or not, that say 3:30 in the morning is prime time for appearances.
Which, that kind of makes some sense on a personal level with me. My wife and I, before I got my teaching job and we moved, we had purchased about 120-year-old house. And from day one, there were weird things that happened. Most of the things I never saw or heard, but my wife would see a cat running across the floor out of the corner of her eye, and when she turned to look, it wouldn't be there. But she would report to me, she'd get up to go to the bathroom at about 3 a.m, and she'd have to walk through our son's nursery. He was just a few months old at the time. And she said to me that she'd seen a light over his crib that looked like Tinkerbell from Peter Pan. And when she stared at it, it would slowly fade away into nothing. And I'd never seen it, so I was a little bit skeptical until I got up at about 3 a.m. and saw the very same thing. Didn't see it at any other time of the day or night, but it was around 3 o'clock each time we saw it.
Hmm.
The real interesting thing about that, I'm not sure if you're familiar with a psychic named Joyce Morgan.
No, I'm not.
She's one of the psychics who helped She's died of cancer in the last 6 months, I think. But she helped police departments find missing people. They did a couple of specials on her on Court TV. So she was fairly well known.
You know, actually, I think I know who you're talking about. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, she lived in Missouri. We'd never met. She had no idea who I was. I called her one day just to talk about one haunted spot in particular. And while we were chit-chatting before I got off the phone, I mentioned the light in the baby's room. I didn't mention my son's name. I didn't mention that my son was a boy. I just called him the baby. And when I told her about the light, she said, "That's just your grandfather, Sam. He's looking after his namesake," which my baby's, well, he's three now, but his name's Sam. And, of course, my grandfather's name was Sam. I didn't, just the randomness of that to come out was pretty interesting.
Did your son ever say anything about the light, ever seeing anything?
He was, the baby was, he was really, really little at the time, just a few months old. And
so he's not ever expressed any, you know, like, hey, there's a friend I play with, you know, or things.
Grandpa says, you know, he's happy or anything like that.
No, and we haven't seen the light for, gosh, it's been going on 4 years now.
Hmm.
So it didn't follow you to the new house?
No.
Hmm.
Which is just fine with me.
Well, I can't say I really blame you for that.
Yeah,
you
know, I'm. The paranormal is fun if it's happening to somebody else.
Yeah, that's true.
I love reporting on it. I don't want it to visit.
Well, you know, if anybody who watches Ghost Hunters or a lot of these ghost shows that have been on History Channel, Discovery Channel, you see the reference to a repetitive action, what appears to be an echo of the past. Do a lot of your ghost stories from your book fall into that sort of category where it looks like the same action over and over again?
Some of them do. One in particular in Wilson's Creek that I mentioned before, there was it's one of the largest battles in Missouri during the Civil War. I've talked to a couple of different people who were in my book who have seen troops of Unions or the line of Union soldiers marching through a creek up over a rise and they disappear. And they've seen this on a number of different occasions, the same thing. I actually read a couple of things online in the last year that sounded just like the stories that these people had told me. That's not as common as a lot of other experiences. I've talked to a lot of people who have very personal experiences. One is a reenactor at Fort Osage in Sibley, Missouri. A Osage Indian tribe lived near this fort, and this one Indian, American Indian, would come into the fort, sneak in at night if he had spotted something that was out of the ordinary, and he would tell the post commander. This reenactor was staying the night in the post commander's bedroom, and so another reenactor was in there with him. The other reenactor saw an Indian come into the room, lean over, pull a blanket up over this first reenactor, whisper something to him, and leave. The guy heard what he whispered to him and was able to track down some Osage Indians who translated it. He asked, "Are you warm enough?"
Wow.
Yeah, and the doors were locked from the inside. So that was a very, very personal experience. That was a one-on-one sort of thing.
And I take it the reenactor, the reason that he had to go ask for a translation is because he was not familiar with the Osage language.
Right, right. Yeah. Exactly. He heard the words and after the experience wrote them down so he would remember them and then went and got a translation.
Now, you mentioned Wilson's Creek and Fort Osage, and listeners may not know that Missouri had more battles in the Civil War than just about any other state in the Union. I think it's second or third behind, like, Tennessee and you know, one other state, I forget. But in addition to Wilson's Creek, there were, the battle outside Kansas City, there was also the massacre near Centralia, Missouri, which was not far from Columbia. Did you find in your research that there seemed to be a higher number or more reported hauntings in areas where battles have been fought?
Yes, absolutely. Lone Jack, Missouri, which was, I believe, where the John Wayne character Rooster Cogburn lost his eye. But the Battle of Lone Jack was another really bloody battle, and there have been numerous upon numerous reports from different people about sightings there throughout the years. The Anderson House in Lexington, Missouri, was the site of the Battle of the Hemp Bales. It was a three-day battle, and it was very vicious and bloody. And there are quite a few reports from that place also. So yes, when there's been a battle, one, lots of deaths; two, lots of violent deaths. There seems to me to be a correlation between that and ghost sightings.
Hmm. In your research, have you talked to people, researchers who can explain why that is?
The general, I guess, consensus about why ghosts stick around are because they either don't know they're dead, or they have something that they haven't finished that they want to finish before they pass on. And this, both of those explanations could kind of fit in with that. If it's a war, yes, you weren't there for the ending of it, so you don't have something finished.
Mm-hmm.
During the attack, you didn't realize you were hit. You don't know you're dead. That could be another explanation, for the battlefields at least.
When you talk to friends like the physicist you were mentioning earlier for your Shadow People book, what is the explanation that's given for that? For ghosts, do they have a scientific explanation?
No, and a couple of physicists I've talked to, they go ghost hunting. They say, we're scientists. You know, if somebody's going to find ghosts, I want it to be us, because then people are going to give us credit. You know, they're going to credit us. They're going to believe us because, you know, we're PhDs. We're not just somebody running around a cemetery at night with an EMF meter. As for explanation, they really, really don't have an explanation as to what they are. They mainly have explanations as to what they're not. But they know something's out there. They just are looking for a scientific way to prove it.
Have you talked with any theologians, any pastors or priests in the course of your research? And if so, what did they have to say about the phenomena?
Well, I really haven't. For my first book, I didn't go that avenue at all. For my book on Shadow People I'm working on, I'm planning on devoting an entire chapter on religion and Shadow People and where they fit. So far, the Vatican hasn't returned my calls.
Well, you brought up your...
that's funny, but I'm serious.
I'm surprised they won't, and they may actually with the Shadow People, because they have an entire unit now of exorcists that they're training. They're getting back into the old ways.
Yes, after years of denying they did that anymore, I recently read that.
Yeah. Well, so tell us about Shadow People. What are those?
They are, I mentioned at the beginning of the interview that there were two instances when I was young that made me interested in the paranormal.
Mm-hmm.
Shadow People was the other one. And this was back in the 70s when I was between 8 and 12. And I would go to bed and see these things walking through my room and into the hallway. Shadow people are, for the most part, two-dimensional. There have been reports of three-dimensional, but usually people report a two-dimensional, blacker-than-night, human-shaped figure that is mobile. It's walking. It walks down the hall of their house, walks to their room, walks, out through an open door. A lot of times they look like they're walking with a purpose, like they're going somewhere maybe in a hurry. Most of the time they don't even seem to notice that people are around them. It's when they do notice people are around them that really starts to scare people. And I'm right now trying every avenue I can, and I've got quite a few trying to explain what these things are. Again, the religious aspect I haven't been able to tackle yet, but at least from the scientific viewpoint, I know they're not a gas, a solid, or a liquid. That's where I am.
I remember I did a little reading on Shadow People sometime back for a book that I'm writing, and, well, of course, I write fiction, so it's a totally different approach from what you do. But if I remember correctly, they tend to fall into two or three different shapes and descriptions. Like there's one man with a hat.
The hat man.
Yeah.
He's got, like, some people that I've talked to have reported a derby, but mostly it's a fedora, which I find very odd and interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, one is just basically human shape. Another one is the hat man. And the third, which I think is creepier, wears like a monk's, you know, a cloak.
Right.
You know, Grim Reaper-esque type thing. And, yeah, those are the three major forms that people have talked to people about. I've also had a lot of reports of shadow cats. Interestingly enough, no other animal, just cats.
That's really interesting in that cats were often used as familiars.
Right, right. Well, I'm not really surprised that it's the cat at all.
Well, we're dog people, so, you know, we'll say cats are, you know, evil anytime.
Yeah.
We'll get letters on that. Just wait.
Now you talk about
about the three different types of entities, the one thing that really solidifies this is, I mean, okay, I saw these things as a kid, so I'm convinced that there's something there. One of the things that really solidifies this for me, however, is the range geographically that I've gotten stories. I've gotten stories of those three types of shadow people from not just all over the U.S. and Canada, but I got one a week or two ago from Portugal. I've gotten shadow people reports from England, France, all across Europe, South Africa, Australia, Japan. I got one from Japan, too. So this, I know one of the explanations, and I kind of agree with this to some extent, is our worldwide media, with the American media basically dominating the globe, and now with the Internet helping that out even more, I can see how maybe these same images can span across different cultures. But it's just fascinating to me that it happens all over the place.
Now, the ones that you saw, am I correct that you saw these more than once, more than a couple times?
Over the span of about 3 or 4 years.
And they ever take notice of you?
Nope. I'm really happy of that.
Did you ever try to attract their attention?
No. I laid there with the covers pulled up to my nose, and I'd yell for my dad, who would come in, and of course, as soon as he turned on the light, there was nothing there. Mm-hmm. I remember one time specifically that I saw one walk out the door and into the hallway, and I yelled for Dad and immediately regretted it because I knew he was going to be walking down that hallway to come and check on me. And I was scared that something was going to happen to him.
Mm. What a horrible feeling.
Yeah, it was. It was pretty terrifying. Of course, everything was okay, but I remember that vividly.
So during that 3 to 4 year period, Jason, these shadow people, it wasn't a repetitive action that happened the same way every time. They seemed to have independent thought, but, you know, and actions.
Yeah, well, they did basically the same things. They were walking through my room, and they'd walk out of my room, and they looked like they were going someplace.
Okay.
It wasn't like they were just milling around. They were going from point A to point B, and point A to point B in between was my room, unfortunately. And a lot of there are a number of different subtypes of these, because people have seen the hooded shadows, and they don't take notice of people, some of them. Some of them do take notice of people. I've got a couple of cases where they've physically attacked someone. The people or the shadow people that don't have cloaks and don't have hats usually don't notice people at all. The ones with hats usually will notice people, but they won't interact with them. They will react if you move toward them. They might back away or walk in the opposite direction, but they don't have any one-on-one interaction. It's the cloaked ones usually that are the problem.
Now, back in December at your blog, From the Shadows, you wrote about an encounter that a couple had on the highway. Tell us about that.
That is a really interesting one. They were driving across country from Washington State to Ohio. They had a moving van. And The wife's name was Lucy. I didn't use her last name because she requested me not to. Normally, in journalistic stories, if you don't give me your full name, I'm not going to deal with you. But when it comes to seeing floating shadow people on the road, I cut people a break. They were driving across country, and Lucy started noticing these black shapes standing at the side of the road. And it wasn't really just at night. She would notice these things during the day, during the whole trip. Finally, she saw one that was in the air, and their moving van was going to go right through it. And she knew she wasn't seeing things that weren't there when her husband reacted to the fact that they were going to hit this thing. And it passed through the cab as they went through it. And then they opened up and talked about it. And they had both been seeing these. They'd just been afraid to confess it to the other one.
Oh, my goodness.
And these things, there were quite a few of them on the trip, and it looked to Lucy like they were going someplace, using their own highways. She kind of described it as sort of, you know, maybe a highway on the astral plane that her and her husband just happened to get a glimpse of. She occasionally sees one or two, you know, every once in a while now at her home, but Nothing like the, it sounded to me like hundreds that they saw on their trip.
Had she ever seen anything like this before that trip?
No.
Do you get reports of animals noticing these things, like dogs?
Yes, animals and children.
Children, that's interesting.
Well, and I do find this interesting, and I also find it interesting that I stopped seeing shadow people when I was about 12, and the only ghost that I've seen was when I was younger than that. And I don't know if I haven't had any experiences or if I'm just too old to see them now. I don't know. But yeah, the animals, cats and dogs, will react to these things, again, as will kids.
You know, I don't know if it was when you were on Derek's show back in Columbia, but it was a time that you may have been talking to the Ghostbusters from, I can't remember what
New England Anomalies Research, possibly.
That's possible. But there was a local mom who called in, and her toddler was seeing something, and they were interacting with something, only this was a poltergeist in their home. But the little boy referred to this entity as Doggy. Although they didn't say that they felt that it was a dog, they thought it was another little toddler.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But the little boy called it Doggy, and that sent chills down my spine when I heard that.
Well, that sounds similar to a story that in Maryville, where I live, is a small town. With the university, it's probably about 1,300 people. So if anybody has a question about anything paranormal, like my phone rings. But I got a call from a woman who lives in Kansas City, and she grew up in Maryville. And her parents had built a house in 1974, and she and her sisters were young teens at the time. They never noticed anything. Their mom would notice a lot like the shadow cat my wife noticed in our house. But when the girls grew up and got married and started having families, they'd bring their children in. These kids would all see something. They called this entity David, a little boy named David, and all of them were scared of David because David would pinch them, pull their hair, take toys away, knock over blocks, and just terrorize these kids. And only one child seemed not to, you know, David didn't bother him. And I interviewed this woman's sister, and she said she was sitting on the couch with this child, and they were flipping through a TV guide, and an ad for a monster movie came up, and a little boy stopped her, and he pointed to it and said, "There, that's David. It's my friend David."
Huh.
Which was extremely creepy, but none of the adults had ever seen this until the youngest sibling was like 9 months pregnant. She was staying with her mom for a couple of days, and she got up to go to the bathroom in the middle of the night and saw a little boy with blonde hair and knickers standing in the middle of the hallway that stared at her and then faded out into nothingness.
Hmm.
But the kids seeing the thing, and the woman was pregnant when she saw this, so that might, I don't know, tie in.
When you were talking to the various people for both your books, have Is there a particular time of year that you find heightened activity? In other words, well, supposedly at the various Wiccan Sabbaths, there is among Wicca, and of course I don't practice that, but because we do try to understand all of these various ways of interpreting the world, I read about it, and one of the claims is that there are certain times of the year that the veil between the worlds mm-hmm. is thinner.
I've heard this before. I haven't really explored into that too much about when paranormal activity happens, if it happens more at one time than another. Mm-hmm. It is basically my opinion that paranormal activity happens more in the spring, late spring, summer, and early fall, because it happens outside at that time, because, you know, in the winter it's too cold for people to go out and notice it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the same at night. Things happen at night, seem to happen more often at night, because, well, the lights are off, the ambient noise really isn't there. You don't hear horns honk. There's nothing to distract you. It's mm-hmm. just you and the night. So, I mean, this is just a personal feeling. It's really not based on any of this, but I just really think things are going on all the time. Mm-hmm. And it's just at certain times, just from the world around us, you know, things happening that we're able to notice them more than others.
A theme that you've mentioned a couple of times in your column from the shadows is that it appears sometimes that when somebody peers through that veil and spirits begin to cross through and make contact, that it's very difficult to close that again. Am I understanding correctly? And what are some of the examples that you've heard in of this sort of thing happening?
This is absolutely. This is why I don't go anywhere near Ouija boards. Mm-hmm. I don't throw out invitations into the evening, because yes, at these times, if something's there and you give it an invitation, it will come through. And what comes through is not going to be something nice. Going with the Christian perspective, what in the Bible does it tell us that we cannot have communication with the spirit world?
Mm-hmm.
Well, no, it tells us we should not, but it tells us that it's possible, but
right,
we should
not.
Right,
the very fact that you're warned not to do it, I think the assumption is that it's possible.
Okay, so that's pretty good authority that we probably shouldn't be messing with this.
Mm-hmm.
So anything that you're giving an invitation to is not going to be something pleasant. It's probably going to be something evil, because if it is a good entity, it's going to be following those rules. And the evil entity will not. And all of the experiences, I'll give you one. There's a deer hunter down in South Missouri. His name's Chris Banks. I had a two-part story on him. He was getting ready for deer season, and he had he's got a little trailer set up. He's got a bunch of property in southern Missouri, and it's away from everywhere. He said you can't see a street light, can't hear a horn honk, not a street light, but any house light or anything. It's just in the middle of nowhere. And he was going to spend the night there and get up early and hunt. And he was having a few beers by the campfire, and he was by himself and just shouted out, "Hey, if anybody's out here and you want to come sit by the fire, you're more than welcome." And a couple of things happened that night. One, his deer camera flashed. He had an automatic deer camera set up, and it flashed and it caught something that wasn't a deer. It was a couple of lights. Again, someplace where you can't see lights other than stars. And these were lights in the forest. One looked like a star. The other looked like a moving ball, moving as in there were streaks behind it. He captured that he couldn't explain. And his trailer door was locked, and his trailer was shaken back and forth by something. When he finally got out, there was no evidence for anything. And since then, whenever he walks through a room, doors open and shut, and he doesn't touch them. So he's firmly convinced that he invited something to join him that just hasn't left him alone.
Now, the picture that his deer camera took, is that the picture that you've got posted at your website?
Yes, it should just have been a week or two ago. It's probably still up on the front page.
Oh yeah, I see that.
We'll post a link to this again for people listening at PIDradio.com so you can take a look at this picture. Again, captured by an automatic camera out in the area where there shouldn't be any lights. You also mentioned the story of a woman who found that the door was difficult to close again. Somebody who did experiment with a Ouija board as a young person and has found it difficult to get away from these things since then.
Right. This has... bad things have followed her ever since then. But I don't want to just crack on Ouija boards. I'll give you a very similar example that had to do with a woman. She's a doctor. Again, had asked me not to give her name, but she her first name is Mary. She lives outside of St. Louis. She'd purchased a really old farmhouse and started to renovate it. And she was going through an odd period of her life and bought a book on spells. Just she thought it would be fun to just try and throw a couple of spells. And ever since she tried that, there have been footsteps in her house, and it escalated from there, from doors opening and shutting to things missing to finally she started seeing a dark, hulking man shape following her through her house. I've since lost contact with her, so I don't know what the status is now. But it's not just Ouija boards. Mm-hmm. Any sort of attempted contact with the other side is enough to open that veil.
Well, you know, as I've said, we have talked with many pastors and gentlemen and ladies who are engaged in the activity of taking on the supernatural forces head on, some from a Christian worldview and some not. And almost universally, they say it is possible to open certain gateways. And once open, it's very difficult to close them again. So the rule there is don't open them.
don't open them. Exactly. Well, and sometimes it's something you're not even going to think about. I just interviewed this young man. He's a college student, and I interviewed his father, and I still got somebody else to talk to about the case. But he had, a little over a year ago, he joined a fraternity and got alcohol poisoning one night, and his breathing stopped and his heart stopped a couple of times, and doctors were able to revive him. But ever since he's come back, he's had problems. A couple of weeks after he got home and recovered, he was in church, and he said, in his head, a voice said, get out now. And he kind of ignored it until he got under a lot of physical distress. His head was splitting, his chest started hurting, and as soon as he walked outside, he was fine. But then his voice told him to walk home. Then it told him to get in his car. And then he didn't know anything for 3 hours. 3 hours later, he was sitting at a gas station 100 or so miles away. So the invitation that this young man sent out was the lifestyle. The lifestyle he was leading and the fact that he was technically dead for a short period of time. Something felt that there was some kind of a weakness there, mm-hmm. and latched on to it.
Well, that's that's another common theme that I've heard from people, stories that if you are technically dead for a short period of time, that there are times that something comes back with you.
Right, and this sounds exactly what happened to this young man, and it escalated to the point to where the entity, which he could now see, was commanding him to kill his girlfriend.
And
the young man finally went to his father, who's deeply religious, and they sat down and prayed, and they're pretty sure they succeeded in banishing this thing from the boy and from their house. So he's recovered back in school now, and he seems to be doing pretty well. But yeah, that's pretty terrible. It's one of the, as a matter of fact, the notebook when I interviewed this young man, I wouldn't even take it home.
Huh. You know what?
It disturbed me so much.
I can't really blame you for that. You know, and if you read the Bible very much at all, you begin to understand that there are rules, even in the supernatural world. It's constructed in a way similar to ours, in that there are rules, there are laws of that have to be obeyed. You know, like we have the law of gravity that we can't disobey. Mm-hmm. Or at least most of us can't. And in that, for instance, in the book of Job, when Satan wanted to challenge Job, he had to get permission. And I think that that follows with these ghosts. There are certain rules, and if you break those rules, then they can come after you.
Mm-hmm. Like inviting a vampire into your house.
Yeah, you don't do that. Silly
Can't
boy.
Can't cross the threshold until you extend the invitation. But taking that a step further, I've talked with a deliverance minister, exorcist, who believes from his experiences that there are actually ranks of demons that, and if you try to take on one that's too strong, you actually are just getting yourself into deeper trouble. In other words, you need to go about mm-hmm. things a certain way. But something that is referred to often by ghost hunters, and I think you found this to be the case too, Jason, correct me if I'm wrong, is that some spirits, entities seem to be territorial. In other words, they only occupy one place, and if you move, they won't follow you. Did you find that, or are there some that will attach themselves, wherever you go?
Well, there are a couple of trains of thought on this. There do seem to be quite a few that are absolutely attached. The ones in the Limp Mansion, they're there. The ones that at the battlefield, they're all there. The Jesse James home, which I did a chapter of in Haunted Missouri, ghosts seem to be in and out of there. People have reported seeing Frank and Jesse out there at different times, and people have also reported seeing Frank at the jail where he was kept in Independence for 6 months. They still keep his it's a museum now, but they still keep his jail cell all made up, just like it was when Frank was there. And every once in a while, somebody will come in and it'll look like somebody slept in a bed. Hmm. Or one year they put a Christmas tree in Frank's room, and the very next morning it was tossed out into the hallway. But certain spirits seem to be able to go where they want to. And some of them, which is, I kind of feel silly doing this, but I think it's extremely important. Whenever I've gone into a purportedly haunted place, before I leave, I say thank you and stay here. Please don't follow me home, because I've talked to too many people who've felt like they've dragged something home with them.
Mm-hmm.
That may relate to, again, certain ranks or orders of demons with different or entities that have different abilities
and powers.
It could
be the door that the entity came through.
Exactly.
You've talked about shadow people. I'm curious, do you get many stories, or have you had any stories about a lady in white?
There are a couple of hauntings regarding, they call her the lady in white. One is just south of St. Joseph, Missouri, in a cemetery. People have reported seeing a woman in a long flowing white dress walking through the cemetery. And that's a similar story that I've heard a couple places other than that in the state.
Yeah, I asked that because I've seen that seems to be another type of activity, that it's the white lady or the lady in white. And often times it's little kids who see this one too. And it seems to be, just in picturing it, the opposite of the shadow person, because again, very often the shadow man, because from my reading, it tend to be that these things are perceived as male, but the white, they always seem to be women.
That's interesting, because the all but one report, and I've got probably 250 shadow person encounters collected so far. There's only been one that the person who witnessed it thought it was a female, but he said that he only sensed that it was a female. The body was, he couldn't tell just from looking at it, but what he felt that it was female. Everybody else has been definitely male.
How far back do these reports go in history?
And that's still something I'm trying to find. I had a couple interesting conversations with literature professors, because psychiatrists have told me that these images are just Jungian archetypes. And they're so common that people will recognize them. So I've tried to go back into literature, because if people are recognizing these from something they've seen and heard, maybe that they've been tackled in literature. And entities like this have been reported. Have been covered in literature for hundreds of years, but past that, I really don't know.
Well, you know, Missouri has a lot of Indian tribes. Have you talked with, for instance, the Osage tribe? Have you talked with anybody there about possible, you know, shadow people?
No, but I have spoken with a couple of people from, I believe they're from California, who said that in, at least with them, and they said with many Indian tribes, is that there's something called the Three Sisters, which are three black shadow entities that are omens of impending doom.
Sort of like the Fates.
Right, and it's this is something that I'm still exploring. I traded emails with Brad Steiger. Assuming you're familiar with Brad, and he's completely convinced that of these three sister entities from experiences that he's reported on also.
Another phenomenon that's pretty well known around, I think it's Rolla, isn't it? The ghost lights, is that the Rolla area, or am I thinking Joplin?
You're thinking Joplin.
Joplin. Tell us about the ghost lights.
The ghost light has been seen in that area since the early 1800s. The legend has it, and which is really funny because there's the exact same legend is in Hannibal, Missouri. But American Indian tribes there at that time, the daughter of a warrior wanted to marry another warrior. Daddy wasn't so happy about that. So he had the couple chased off of a cliff. And ever since that point, people have reported seeing the way it was described to me, is a basketball-sized glowing light. At that point, going through the forest, now coming up this this specific road that leads into Missouri from Oklahoma. And I have interviewed people who've seen it in the 1920s and people who've seen it in the last few years. It's the exact same report. People are sitting out there in their cars. This light comes up the road, dances on their hood, comes through the cab of the car, and keeps going down the road. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers in 1946 came down to the area to prove that this, you know, to prove what this was, and their explanation was lights from the highway. Which doesn't explain the people who saw this back in the 1800s.
No.
Now, 1946, this was just before the beginning of the rash of UFO reports, which started, of course, in July of 47 with Kenneth Arnold and then the Roswell crash.
Right.
But 46, you know, again, just sort of predated that by not very much.
Although I think there are actually some sightings in 46. It's just the Roswell crash.
It was the big one.
Yeah, the one we all remember.
Well, there's a big one in Missouri in 1941 that has gotten some publicity, but not nearly as much as Roswell. In between Sykeston and Cape Girardeau, in 1941, a Baptist minister got a call from the local sheriff saying, you know, you need to come out here to this road and administer last rites because there was a plane crash. And he went out, drove out there, and there was Army, the Army was all over the place. FBI was there. And the people the people who were flying the craft weren't people, and the craft was not an airplane. He didn't tell anybody about this because he was told not to until he was getting ready to die, and he told his daughter about it. And, of course, that would predate Roswell by 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
I interviewed a woman whose father worked in the Army Air Corps. At that time, and he was stationed down close to Sykeston, and he told her when he was getting ready to pass on about this incident. And when she went to investigate it, she found people in rest homes who told her these same stories of what they saw. They saw these little gray aliens. They saw a wrecked spaceship. But when she went to look at all of the records from the fire department, the Army Air Force, the Sheriff's Department, all of those records from 1941 had been burned in a fire.
How convenient.
Oh, how convenient.
And that's not the strangest thing. She went to the local Sykeston newspaper, and there were, on the microfilm, there were blacked out sections of copy.
You're kidding me.
No, that one was pretty telling.
That's pretty
that
bold.
Somebody didn't want something to get out. Well, oh yeah, exactly. Very bold.
What town again was the crash in?
It was between Sikeston, Missouri, and Cape Girardeau, Missouri.
That was down in southeast Missouri, down near the Boot Heel.
Right.
A little north of the Boot Heel.
Yeah.
So down along the Mississippi. 1941. We need to do some research on that, because I'm not familiar with that story.
I'm not either.
Well, I've got a story on it and on my blog. It was one of the first fromtheshadows.com. It was one of the, or fromtheshadows.blogspot.com. It was one of the first stories that I'd written for my column.
And again, we'll put a link to that at PIDradio.com. The URL for the From the Shadows column posted every week to the web is From the Shadows, but it's from-the-shadows.blogspot.com. A lot of a variety of stories there, including the most recent one about adventures in time travel. So covers everything from strange creatures, aliens, experiences with shadow people, the dangers of opening gateways to the other side, and this report. I'm going to have to go back and read it now, of the 1941 crash of something in southeast Missouri.
Jason, are you still accepting stories for your books, or are you planning a third book?
Well, I'm planning as many books as I can write, but I'm taking stories all the time. If it's not something that will go into a book, it will definitely be something that will go on From the Shadows.
Do you want to give out your email address on the show, or do you want us to just link to it?
How about both?
We'll do both.
Oh, we'll
do
both.
That would be terrific.
How do people contact you?
My email address is Jason Offit. That's JASONOF as in Frank, F as in Frank, UTT, at hotmail.com.
All right.
And I would love to hear stories.
And again, the blog is From the Shadows, the weekly column dealing with the paranormal. Of course, he's got other writings and books out there about life in general, what it's like to be a dad, at jasonoffit.com, his personal website. He's the author of Haunted Missouri, a ghostly guide to the Show Me State's most spirited spots, and you can find a link to that at his blog. We'll also put a link to that at pidradio.com.
Yeah, where can we pick up a copy of your book?
It's... And since it's localized in Missouri, probably not in a bookstore that's not a Missouri bookstore.
Well, can our listeners buy it online?
They can buy it at Amazon.com, Borders.com, BarnesandNoble.com, or Truman State University Press, TSU. I'm feeling really stupid right now.
Yeah, we'll find
that link and post it. That's the great thing about doing post-production on a podcast. You can go back and fix things. It's works out really great. And, of course, he's got a little From the Shadows Cafe Press type store at Zazzle. So put a link to that, too, and get yourself a From the Shadows t-shirt to support the research that Jason's doing into these things on the other side of the veil.
I got to ask about Poops Funny. Isn't that the name
of it? Yeah, Poop's Funny, he's 11 now, he would have been probably 6 years old. We were driving the car, and one of the games we played was just to name a genre, whether it be mystery, action, superhero, monster, some sort of a genre like that, and just make up a story about it. And one day, the topic was comedy. So my son started rattling off this story about this guy who went to Poopsa Hut, and and he drank a Poopsie instead of a Pepsi. And I'm like, why all this stuff about poop? And he sat there for a couple of seconds thinking, and he said, because poop's funny.
Well, Hollywood producers have known that for years.
And, but, you know, something like that coming from a six-year-old at the time, I'm thinking that's just right on.
Oh, yeah. Gosh.
Jason Offit is our guest. It's been a wonderful hour that's gone too quickly. We'll definitely have to talk with you again, especially as you get closer to getting the book on Shadow People ready to go. And, again, links to his websites and to his book at PIDradio.com. Jason, thanks for spending an hour with us.
Wonderful. I would spend more.
And coming up in the next couple of weeks, barring any huge events around the world, we're planning to talk to the Collins brothers once again. And David Flynn will be talking about the neoglyphs in Bolivia.
Flynn has come out of hiding.
Yes. So look forward to some very interesting shows coming up. Meanwhile, you can always discuss these at the Piercing the Darkness forum and email address if you've got a question or comment, Derek@peeringintodarkness.com.
Or you can write to me, Sharon@peeringintodarkness.com.
Until next time, I'm Derek Gilbert.
I'm Sharon Gilbert. Bye-bye, everybody.
On demand.
This is PID Radio.